opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, everyone, and welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio, coming to you from the beautiful new studios of WWDB AM 860 here in Philadelphia. And we're streaming live on WWDBAM.com. You can contact us here at Boomer Generation Radio, just a reminder, at BoomerGenerationRadio@gmail.com, or you can leave us a message or check in with the Boomer Generation Radio page on Facebook. And we want to welcome all of you again and bring you this greeting and message from our major sponsor over at Kendall.
Hi, this is Kendall staff member Sheila Sylvester. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio was brought to you by Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services in 8 states that advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential. Please join us in Together Transforming the Experience of Aging. To learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L, visit discoverkendall.org or call toll-free 888-759-0128.
Welcome back today to Boomer Generation Radio, and we're very honored to have a couple of very, very exciting guests here this morning on our first segment. David Friedman joining me in studio, and Dr. Jessica Israel joining us by phone from, I think, beautiful Ocean County. Dr. Israel, are you on the line?
I am, yes.
Hi, good morning. Welcome.
Hi.
Thank you for calling in, and we just want to get right to, because I know you have a very busy schedule and lots to talk about, and the theme of this first segment really is issues dealing with Medicare, a real important issue as our generation begins to age out, and according to the government, and we know the government is never lies, that approximately 10,000 people turn 65 in this country every single day. I think they said about 8,000 every a second or so, an amazing number. And David, who is here in studio, really representing somebody who's worked in the healthcare field, is a consumer, is a baby boomer. And Dr. Israel, you're involved with this from a professional point of view up in northern New Jersey. Well, for us, northern New Jersey. And you were written up quite lovingly in a recent article in the Asbury Park Press, if I'm not mistaken, about the whole explosion of baby boomers. And there was an interesting line in there, Dr. Israel, about the fact that, according to the article, the baby boomers now, as opposed to being healthier than previous generations, are not quite as healthy as previous generations. Are you finding that to be true?
I would say probably yes. I think that is true. Really, what I see because I specialize in geriatrics is frail older adults. So I am right now taking care of some, believe it or not, still some baby boomer parents
wow,
of that
right,
generation.
Right.
But starting to sort of get their children as our patients too, because our practice starts around age 65. I mean, I think that there are, you know, some significant chronic illnesses that patients don't realize are causing long-standing effects. And I think the biggest culprit and probably the most difficult disease to manage is diabetes, because when it's doing its dirty work, people don't know. And then it's only after these end-stage consequences appear that it's a very, very big deal.
You've developed, according to this, or work with a team approach to working with your patients in this geriatric practice. Could you walk us through what exactly that means? And if you can, then how does that impact the cost to Medicare on a team approach?
Sure. I am lucky enough to work with an amazing team, and a lot of the best care of older adults and certainly our most medically frail happens with a team. Basically, we have put together a team of people from across different disciplines. So it's multidisciplinary, meaning that there are physicians, there are nurses, there are social workers, there are case managers, there are representatives from hospice care, representatives from rehab facilities, representatives from nursing homes. In our area, we've put together kind of the most common group of people who work together. And every Tuesday, in fact, in about 15 minutes, we'll sit around the table and we will talk about patients that are admitted to our program. The really great thing about it is that it's a group of professionals really working in different organizations, and some of them are even competing organizations, but working together to get the right outcome for certain patients. So we admit patients who are over the age of 65 with two or more comorbidities, a recent hospitalization. There are certain red flags that get you automatically into the program, and one of those is readmissions. Hospitals are penalized for patients who are readmitted soon after they are discharged. That's going to be a very big thing in the future for hospital reimbursement. So putting together, and not just from the hospital perspective, but from the patient perspective, so many things fall through the cracks when someone leaves the threshold of one setting and goes into another. And we really concentrate on those transitions. What are the things that we know right ahead of time are going to make a difference for this person when they leave the hospital to let them leave safely and without adverse effects? So the hospital is very into what we do because we prevent readmissions, because we decrease length of stay, because we talk about goals of care on the first day of the hospital admission so that there's no wondering about where this family is or where this patient is in this process. So they like what we do. But in the long run, it's really the patients is the reason that we do it, and they're the ones that get the biggest benefit. It's all about communication. So having so many people at the table to talk about one person puts together a much bigger picture than you have when everyone's operating in a solo place.
So one of the things that is emerging, obviously, is this approach of keeping people coming back or readmissions to the hospitals obviously impacts Medicare and the expenditures of Medicare to the hospitals and the physicians. So is this, do you really see this as a wave of the future in decreasing the amount of drain on the Medicare expenditures? And does this in any way, shape, or form, based upon your experience, compromise the care that a patient receives?
So I absolutely see it as a wave of the future, and I don't think it compromises patient care. In fact, I think it makes patient care better. So one example I'll give you is when we first started this program, we started it with a grant that we got from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We picked a particular population to start our work in, and we chose older adults with dementia. Right? And that's a tough population. And we tried to reduce readmissions for a very medically frail population that with dementia. And the thing that we learned, which is where I think this benefits patients in a huge way, is that when we looked at why those patients are coming into the hospital, we were able to divide them out into two things. So sometimes they're coming back into the hospital for something that you cannot prevent, you know, maybe someone falls and fractures their hip. Clearly, they're going to come back in and get that hip fixed, right? So there are these medical reasons. But then there are reasons that are really not what people would consider traditional medical, but that's what we're taking care of in the hospital, like caregiver breakdown, like no access to services at home, like no communication about goals of care. Things like that, these sort of more social indicators that make a person unable to do what they need to do to be home and be safe. And a lot of it is about accessing the right service. So our team was able to help people access what they need so that they can remain successful at home. It's not so much about preventing someone from coming back in. It's about enabling them to live outside of the hospital with success and with the tools in place and services that they need. So I think that hospitals are definitely going to be penalized, but in the long run, what we're doing, it's not about hospital economics. It's about providing the right care for patients. I mean, when I was a resident, I took care of an elderly man. This is the first case I ever had as a resident. He was an elderly man in Elmhurst, Queens with pneumonia. And I fixed his pneumonia. I gave him the right antibiotic, and all the lab tests got better, and the temperature curve I was following. And then I went to discharge him home, and the nurse said to me, "But he can't walk. You left him in bed all week." You know, it was a really big lesson, because there's so much that goes into taking care of someone to make sure that when they leave the hospital, they're successful. And when you look at what you consider traditional medicine, maybe you just look at the pneumonia and you don't see those other things. So I think this preventing readmissions, it makes you look at those things, which are critically important.
So this is part of, we've had some other people on the show talking about person-centered care, mm-hmm. As opposed to a patient. You're really looking at the holistic, a person, where they're coming from emotionally, physically, spiritually, as part of the caring and the care team, with a theory uh-huh. being that if you approach somebody as a whole human being, that the eventual readmissions and hospitalizations and costs will then eventually decrease. So am I on the right track with what your approach is?
Absolutely. I think you have to look at people that way. And even a little further, you have to look at the person and their environment and the family and the people that are with them. You have to look at the whole thing in order to ensure the right amount of success. And when you think about it, you know, from our own perspectives, that's what we want when we go to a physician. We want someone to look at our medical illness in the context of who we are and where we live and what our goals are and what our successes are.
So, Dr. Israel, I want to thank you. I know you have rounds to do, and you, as you told me before, it's a jam-packed day. So, no, I really do appreciate it, and thank you very, very much for really providing an opening to something I want to follow up with David, who's here, on some of the Medicare impact, especially the low income and the impact of people and negotiating this maze, because part of the other side of this conversation is those of us who are consumers, and how do we begin to even approach the whole package of insurance and Medicare and, God forbid, Medicaid. So, Dr. Israel, thank you very, very much. Continued success. Keep
Thanks.
In touch, and have a good day. Take care of yourself.
I will. Thanks for having me.
You take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, David, you walk the walk both as a boomer, somebody who's a caregiver, has been a caregiver for parents, somebody who's worked in the healthcare field as a provider. Yes, this team approach is gaining popularity, and yes, there's imagine you'll tell me if I'm wrong, an attempt on the part of a lot of the government and healthcare providers to control costs, because the costs are expanding, allegedly, as we get older. How do you begin to negotiate? Walk me through from a family's particular point of view. How do we begin to negotiate this maze of Medicare? It's overwhelming sometimes.
It can be overwhelming for people that are uninformed. Let's start by talking about what is Medicare. Medicare is a way for senior adults to get health care. Now, it is a government system, to be honest with you, I'm going to give you one example. As people are turning over 65, and the baby boomers are right in there and probably the largest group in the next 20 years, the costs just of care for an Alzheimer's patient throughout the United States is now $50 billion a year. They expect that cost to go up in 2030 to $10 trillion a year. Now, that's if all things stay normal, and hopefully they will.
Right.
So let's talk about the only way that senior adults really have to pay for all of this is through Medicare programs. So let's talk about what the different Medicare programs are. Part A is your hospitalization. It doesn't cost anything. Part B is your doctors. For Part B, you will pay a monthly premium, which can be taken, deducted right from your Social Security. It usually is about $109 a month right out of your Social Security. Part C is what we call a Medicare Advantage, which is really an HMO. It will require you to go to a network of physicians and stay within that network to control the costs. Now, there are two ways you can get a Part C Medicare Advantage. You can buy it privately. Medicare itself will provide it, but again, there's a cost for that, okay? Now, all of the other parts of Part D is your prescription plan.
Right.
Okay? And again, you can get a private prescription plan or you can get a prescription plan through Medicare. Okay? If you have Part C or you opt for Part C, most Part C's, whether you get them privately or through Medicare, include the Part D prescription plans.
And do all these B, C, and D premiums, are they deducted from Social Security?
Yes, they can all be deducted right from your Social Security. Now,
So somebody who, let's say, gets $1,200 a month Social Security, if they opt for B, C, and D, they could potentially have that $1,200 reduced to something like $800 a month, correct?
Potentially, yes, uh-huh. Yes. Now, there are other parts, E through N, okay? But you don't have to worry about all those different parts because they're all the same. They're what we call Medicare supplements or Medigap programs, okay? And they are sold by insurance companies. And one of the advantages to have a Medicare supplement or a Medigap program is there is no network. You can go to any doctor or any physician that you want. The downside to that is if you take a Medigap program, none of them really come with Part D prescription plan, so you have to get a separate Part D prescription plan.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, you basically need a PhD in healthcare economics to figure this out.
Or call somebody that's qualified to explain it to you.
So that's a good – but that's a good here's something – where are these – there are people – Are there people for whom a family or an individual can pick up, because it can be overwhelming, can pick up the phone and call, I need to make an appointment, here's who I am, here's what I'm getting, Social Security, I have a minimum pension maybe from SEPTA or something, what do I need to do, how do I do this? Are there people like that?
Absolutely. In fact, I work with a woman who sells health insurance and is an expert in all of these fields. And I would suggest if somebody is looking around, don't go to a particular insurance company. Try and find an independent broker, because an independent broker deals with a multiple of insurance companies. The independent broker is not trying to sell one insurance product. They will find a product that fits your needs.
Right.
So that's why I would recommend anybody who's shopping around for any of the Medicare products, find a good independent broker to talk to.
We've had people on, on the show here before and have alluded to this issue, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you about it in more detail. They basically say if you have to start thinking about planning this well before you're 65 years of age, that it can take that much time to just to figure out what you need and how you need it. Would you agree with that? Or
I really don't. I think if you talk to the right person, you can find a good Medicare plans within 3 months. If you do it yourself, I found when I turned 65 that one of the things that I was getting was tons of mail from insurance companies about
true.
Medicare.
Every day.
That's what makes it confusing for a lot of people, because they're getting all this information from all these different insurance companies. Most people don't even read it all,
right.
Okay? I think I may be one of the weird ones, because what I did was I put everything into a file, and 2 months before I was 65, I opened up and read through everything, threw out what I didn't want and kept what I didn't want. So I became very knowledgeable on my own on Medicare. But I think a lot of people just are not in a position to be able to do that.
So myth or fact, Medicare covers – the basic Medicare, I have my Medicare card, I go into the hospital, covers everything.
Basically, you are correct. It will not cover your prescription
Right.
Plans.
I know it doesn't cover the prescription.
Okay, but it will cover your doctors and your hospitalization. Now, it's important to point out that there are, if you only have Part A and Part B, and even if you there are limitations to what Medicare is going to pay. They won't pay for 100%. Let me give you an example. If you go into the hospital, Medicare will pay for 20 days. After that, there's a cost involved. And after 90 days, that can be as much as $600 a day.
Oh, and a good day, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now, again, the Medicare, the Part C and the Part C and the Parts E through N will protect you from those costs.
So there's a if I go into the hospital and I have to stay 21 days. In other words, what you're saying is Medicare will cover those first 20 days.
Mm-hmm.
As of the 21st, I have to write a check.
Precisely.
Unless I have a supplemental insurance to cover that.
Precisely.
Okay. And what happens to people who have their Medicare then as a secondary insurance? Because a lot of boomers are continuing to work. They're working full time. They're getting pension. They're getting their salary. But they'll get their, they have their Medicare card. Is that a disadvantage, or is that just another, you're lucky because you have a backup?
It's an advantage for working people because your primary insurance will pick up all of the costs before Medicare kicks in.
All right. So that's another advantage
of working.
Keeping working. What, before we start running out of time, and this is just the beginning of a, hopefully a more conversation, what's the impact of the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, on Medicare?
To date, there really has been no impact. When all the Affordable Care stuff started, I really paid very little attention to it because I realized it wasn't going to have any impact on me. So the Affordable Care Act is really meant for people under the age of 65 who can't afford any kind of medical care. And that's why I was that law was passed to begin with.
So the figures seem to be that the ACA is working, and there are millions of people who didn't have health insurance are now on these rosters or registers or whatever they're calling them, and that seems to be cool. I'm concerned, you know, as the 76 million baby boomers start to age out, as you pointed out, they're doing now at 10,000 a day, according to the government. Is there a limit? Have you studied this? You've studied this, and I've certainly read enough books on this and looked at this from a spiritual perspective. But is there a limit? Are we going to reach a limit where we just can't afford all of this?
It could happen, because remember that Medicare comes through your Social Security. Okay? Now, in order to get Social Security, you pay in to Social Security. Okay, and then when you can take it when you're 62, 65, or wait until 70 to take your Social Security. With the increase in the aging population, the question is: are enough people paying in to pay for the people that have earned the right to have Medicare? And with an increasing aging population, my personal opinion is, we really have to address this very, very promptly.
Well, I know, because we've had geriatric economists on, Larry Kotlikoff from BU. I'm thinking of off the top of my head. He spent a whole hour with us and really was very, very concerned that he had this ratio of workers to paying in. And he's documented the fact that it's dropped from post-World War II from 7 workers paying into the funds to now between around 2.5 to 3 full-time workers paying into the funds. So he just basically says, look, all you have to just do the math. There's a real crisis, but nobody wants to deal with this, and no politician not wants to deal with it because it's the third rail or whatever, whatever. But eventually, we're going to have to deal with it because eventually there's just the sheer amount of numbers of people who are going to be pulling into the system.
You're absolutely correct, and one of the things that drives me crazy, Richard, is the politicians who keep saying that Social Security and Medicare is I can't think of the word, an entitlement.
Right, entitlement.
It's not an entitlement. People have paid into this to earn what they get after they turn 65. So politicians who call it an entitlement, I think, are absolutely way off base.
Yeah, it's become a very, very important code word, as if you're taking charity. But for people who are, you know, who've paid into it, and also for people who that's their main source of income. I mean, that is their main source of income. And for low-income families, a person who really needs that, that changes the diet. It's not an entitlement. I earned that. I may have been a waitress at the local diner in South Jersey for my entire working career, but I earned that.
Yeah, paid for it.
I paid for it, and now I'm in that sense entitled to it. But it's what I earned. It's just what I need.
But it isn't a true entitlement like welfare or some other the government program.
No, but it's become the politicization of this.
Precisely.
And then you add this other thing that we wanted to mention, the low-income subsidy issue that's proposed that also could impact low-income families. So, and with the income disparity, the whole geriatric economics of this thing, from what you're talking about, just needs to be addressed, but so far isn't being addressed.
Yes, and there are a number of programs for low-income families, both for Part A and B and for Part D prescriptions. There are different programs. There's a program called called LIS, which stands for Low Income Subsidy, and that will take care a lot of prescription costs. It'll lower the cost of having something to pay for prescriptions. And one of the other beauties of LIS is, as you know, with most prescription plans, there's a donut, which is when you reach a certain amount of payment for prescriptions, the rest of it you pay out of pocket until you reach. Well, there's no donut with LIS.
Right.
So it obviates the need for somebody to actually have to pay for their prescriptions if they're into their donut, because there is no donut.
So we're just about out of time for this segment, but I this conversation will continue. We're going to have more of this conversation. But let me ask you one quick question, a real easy question to end this segment. Given all that you've studied, given all that you've experienced in professional life and personal life, given the realities of the economics of aging, do you think we should be putting a cap on expenditures for Medicare? In other words, you get to this age, I'm sorry, but it's just not economically feasible for us to fund that hip replacement for a 98-year-old. Or is that just so totally anti what we really believe in?
I would hate to see it have to come to that. I really, really would, because it's going to be a tremendous downside for people that really need the medical care.
Right.
And as you said, there's going to be more and more and more of them. So I would hate to see it come to that. Could it? Anything's possible.
In this day and age. Anyway, David Friedman, thank you very much for joining us here in this first segment with Dr. Israel. This is a beginning, hopefully, of a lot more conversations about the insurance conundrum and the insurance issues that all of us are facing, not will be, but all of us are facing. And just again, thank you very, very much. I want to also mention one of our good friends here on Boomer Generation Radio, the Hecht Investment Group of Janie Montgomery Scott, which provides concierge financial consulting and planning services. Using a formal investment process as their foundations, clients receive frequent communication and rapid response to their questions. As we've told you before, there are no needs greater, as you know, than your own when it comes to personal financial planning. And the Hecht Investment Group provides experience, guidance, and an efficient management process that is important in today's environment. Additionally, Hecht and his team can assist you in connecting to the investment banking department, who specializes in assisting middle market companies achieve their strategic goals. We invite you to contact the Hecht Investment Group toll free. You can get them at 855 855-289-2168. That's 855-289-2168. Or visit the HechtInvestmentGroup.com. And the Hecht Investment Group is also on Twitter, LinkedIn, and on Facebook. And a reminder that Jenny Montgomery Scott is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and the SIPC. It's summertime in the city, and probably no better musical interlude to introduce our second segment than a little Beach Boys. See if you remember this one. I do, from when David and I were at Temple University many years ago.
Hi, this is Kendall resident Harry Hammond. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall. Founded on Quaker principles, Kendall provides independent living, assisted living, memory support, skilled nursing and rehabilitation care for older adults in 8 states. Whether you're looking for the intellectual and cultural stimulation of a college town or a big city, Kendall has a community for you. We are together transforming the experience of aging. To learn more, visit Kendall.org. Or call toll-free 888-759-0128.
And welcome back to the second segment of Boomer Generation Radio, coming to you on WWDB AM 860 here in Greater Philadelphia and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And again, you can reach us on BoomerGenerationRadio@gmail.com and on Boomer Generation Radio's Facebook page. And we're very happy to welcome to the second segment of our show Brian Grulli from Bloomberg News. Brian, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it very much.
Happy to be here. Thanks.
So we want to talk a little bit about your reporting and your work on a case that really fascinated me and fascinated a lot of people to the point of being front page story in the New York Times. And when I posted it on my own website, JewishSacredAging.com, got a lot of reaction. And that is this case from the Midwest about Henry Rahans and him being charged with, sexual abuse, some degree of sexual abuse.
Sexual assault.
Sexual
rape,
assault.
Really rape.
With his wife. And so could you give us a little bit of background on this?
Sure. Henry Ray Hines, now he's 79 years old. When this happened, it was last year for the most part in the trial this year. He was 78 when he was charged. Henry is a farmer in northern Iowa in a little near a little town called Garner. Also was a state legislator for many years. A popular guy in his district, a Republican. His wife of many, for 40-some years, died in the early 2000s, and he was crushed by that. That hurt him a lot. He missed Marva Lynn greatly, had nursed her through diabetes for many years of her life. And some years later, he met a woman named Donna Young at church. They were singing in the choir. Donna's husband of many years had also died, and they hit it off. And in a rapid span of 6 months, they got married and were very happy. Both families were very happy about the marriage. The wedding was huge, like 300 some people dancing polkas and eating roast pork. And they live very happily, beekeeping, going to political events like pork feeds and fish fries, and just enjoying each other's company, driving around in the country, which is what Donna really loved to do. But Donna slowly began to get dementia, and in I think it was 2010 or 2011, she was diagnosed with early onset or possible early onset Alzheimer's. And as she deteriorated, of course, her whole family, including Henry, got more and more concerned. And in particular, her daughters were concerned. She has three daughters, and two in particular were concerned for her health. And in early 2014, they endeavored through having power of attorney to have her admitted to a nursing home in Garner. And she entered the Concord Care Nursing Home in the spring of 2014. And a series of events occurred that led up to a pivotal Friday evening when Henry entered her room to visit her. He visited frequently. He visited early in the morning. He visited during the day. He visited in the evening. When he had legislator sessions, he would leave early, see Donna early in the morning, drive 2 hours to Des Moines, spend the day there, and then drive back 2 hours so he could see her in the evening. And on this particular evening, he was in the room for about half an hour. And after he left, the roommate, who was a one-day roommate, Donna had just moved into this room, the roommate was upset. She told nursing staffers she thought she heard sexual sounds coming from the other side of the room. And it's longer story short, a few months later, Henry was accused of having raped his wife, who prosecutors said did not have the cognitive ability to consent to sex. By then, Donna was dead from complications from Alzheimer's, and Henry was forced into a living hell for the next better part of a year. And his trial was just this past spring in Garner.
And he was acquitted, correct?
He was acquitted, yes.
Yes. So your reporting on this and your study of this raises all kinds of issues. This is not going to be an isolated situation. As we alluded to in the first segment, with the explosion of Alzheimer's and dementia expected in the next 20 to 30 years, certainly this is going to be something that's going to have to be dealt with within Alzheimer's facilities, skilled nursing facilities. What have you found? What did you find in your research and your reporting about this?
Well, the overarching feeling, I think, in nursing homes, based on what I've learned, is they have a lot of things they have to do to keep people alive, keep them fed, keep them safe, keep them on their toilet and sleep routines. And a lot of these places are strapped for money because of cuts in Medicaid and Medicare.
Right.
So, dealing with sexuality is down on the list, shall we say, of priorities. It's also particularly to people who are generally quite a bit younger and may have their own, certainly do have their own personal, religious, family, and other beliefs. Frequently, this is just something they don't want to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the yuck factor, if I can put it that way. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean it in a bad way, but that's the way some people view it. And so, for the most part, nursing home facilities would rather not deal with it at all. And in fact, we there was a survey done by AMDA last year, or 2 years ago, excuse me, late 2013, of nursing homes, and a very small percentage of them, almost none, had policies on how to deal with sexuality. And if you don't have a policy, then there's really no guidance. People can do pretty much what they want to do until it comes to a head. You know, a family complains, there's litigation, the cops get called in, or a situation like this arises, mm-hmm. which is highly rare to emerge into the public eye, but did in this case, and I think is likely to do so, you know, more frequently in the future, unless regulators and nursing homes and families, to be honest, come to terms with this.
Yeah, I know in an article that I did many years ago for our professional journal that was actually was just reprinted on a book on sexuality, I did some research for just Jewish homes, and one in New York and one in Arizona. And they had in their part of their admission packets, and this is about 15 years ago when I did 10, 15 years ago when I did this article, a paragraph supporting the right of residents to their own sexual practices and their whatever they may be. In other words, there was a right guaranteed
right.
for
mm-hmm.
sexual privacy. I would imagine that I agree with you that not to have some sort of policy is very, very short-sighted in this day and age as boomers age out. And then I'll raise another question. This has got to come up, and maybe you ran across this in some of your research. We're talking, you know, in the Rahan situation, the quote, normal, heterosexual relationship. But what do you do now with this explosion over the next, you know, how many decades of same-sex relationships, and how do you handle that within the context of a nursing home, especially if some of these homes and facilities are, quote, religious-based in their orientation,
right.
or at least in their purporting to be. What did you have you run across this in your work?
Obviously, step one is, confront it. Admit it's happening. Mm-hmm. This is going to happen. And it's not, this is not to be swept under the rug, and it's not to be looked down upon. In fact, there's lots of evidence in the literature, in academic literature, that sex, and by that I don't mean simply intercourse, but everything from simple touching to cuddling to kissing to hugging, and to intercourse, that all of this is extremely beneficial to people, particularly people who have dementia, who are losing their sight, their hearing, their other senses, and typically the last sense to go is touch. It's the last sense with which a person connects with other people and remains in full appreciation of their own dignity and worth to the rest of the world.
I mean, every
and
article.
Not people, this is a mistake. It's a mistake. I mean, it's just a scientific mistake. It's not just a legal mistake.
And it's on a human level, it's cruel.
I think it can be. Obviously, there are complications to come along with this. If a person is uncomfortable with somebody else's affections,
right.
then obviously the nursing home or whoever it is, the family has to step in, just as we would when they're 25 and 26 years old. No means no. And if people are uncomfortable about it, you have to be aware of that. But to simply deny it, I would agree with you. It is cruel.
And it's
arguably illegal.
Well,
unconstitutional, even some legal scholars argue.
Well, that's interesting. That's a very interesting approach. I know every article that I've read is late as there was another article about 2 weeks ago in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend, again, about another series of studies that the socialization factor, the people keeping people in touch with other people, regardless of their situation, is life affirming rather than, you know, this isolation that so many older adults find themselves in, especially in a facility, and how much the more so when you're dealing with a sense of dementia or Alzheimer's, where there's an isolation of the psyche and the soul and the self at the same time. And just the ability to crawl into bed with your wife or your husband and hold them, maybe that, as you said, that touch may be more life affirming. And I can understand why somebody in the next bed, if it's a semi-private room, who may not have somebody visiting them and who really may be alone, would really react on a variety of psychological levels.
Absolutely. And you know, that's part of simply managing the home in a civil way with respect for all the people there and for all of their views. But going to what you were just earlier saying, you know, last summer, after this alleged incident occurred, of which Henry has now been acquitted, in between that, which was May, and Donna's death in August, Henry was not allowed to see Donna for basically for about 6 weeks. Mm. He didn't see her. And then he saw her right at the end, right before she died. And the Henry and his family members, his sons and daughters, would argue that Donna deteriorated more rapidly because she didn't have her loved one, you know, her husband with her. And we don't have any, there's no scientific evidence of that. We can't prove that. But it's certainly a compelling argument. And to anybody I told that had happened, they were incredulous.
Right.
That a husband we kept away from his wife with no evidence of, you know, at the time, I guess you could say, well, you know, they were investigating, but there were no charges, and there was certainly no evidence of any force or violence or anything else. And in fact, there was evidence that Donna was asking for him, and she couldn't see him.
Yeah,
which is really sad, in my opinion.
We're talking with Brian Grulli, a reporter at large from Bloomberg News, about this rather interesting, disturbing on many levels case of the of Henry Rahans last year and this year in the Midwest. Mr. Grulli, the concept of mental defect, how did that play out within the context of this case? What does it mean?
Well, you know, it's a legal term, and it would have to be defined within, you know, the jurisdiction of the place that is filing a charge. And in this case, it was the state of Iowa. The state brought this case, the attorney general's office, rather than the local county prosecutor, because Henry was a very well-known politician in the county, and they thought no matter what the county did, they'd be accused of, you know, conflict of interest. So the state took it on, and they had to prove that Donna had a mental defect. And there's a lot of ways that could be argued in court. The sexual assault law in Iowa doesn't explicitly define what a mental defect is, but the state Supreme Court had reviewed the statute, the rape statute, in 1980, and said the language of the law is designed to protect those who are so mentally incompetent or incapacitated as to be able to understand, as to be unable, excuse me, to understand the nature and consequences of the sex act. Well, that's a good effort, but it still leaves a lot of room, and it sort of turns the conversation over to people who study dementia and Alzheimer's and what it means as regards people's ability to function, to make decisions. And it is a disease about which we are learning more and more, but is still not very well understood compared to some other diseases. So you can have a person who is perfectly normal to make a decision about, you know, whether they want poached eggs or fried eggs and sunny side up or over easy for breakfast, and then an hour later can't decide what TV station to watch or whether they even want to watch TV.
Right.
They can go in and out. As one person put it, one expert put it, it's like it's not an on-off switch. It's more like a dimmer switch. And somebody who can't decide or can't balance their checkbook, have that ability, might still nevertheless be able to say, yes, I want that appendectomy because I know if I don't have it, I'm going to die.
Right.
And many experts would argue that sex falls into that latter category. As one of the experts I quoted in the story said, it's almost as basic as choosing food. And you can't just assume, as the prosecution did in this case, that because Donna Rayon's failed a very basic memory test, she couldn't remember certain things, that she couldn't make a decision about whether she wanted affection from her husband.
Yeah, it seems so cruel that it's just denying a basic act of you know, touching and loving. Henry was acquitted.
Well,
Henry was acquitted.
Yes.
What did it turn on? What did the prosecution lack, or where did the thing turn?
Well, they had to prove two things.
Right.
A, they had to prove that a sexual act actually occurred.
Right.
And B, they had to prove that Donna didn't have the capacity to say yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
That she just couldn't decide. And it's hard to know exactly where it turned in the jury box because the jury members, for the most part, did not speak about the verdict. One did. And based on what I read, what this woman wrote in her blog, it looked like the jury had a hard time coming to the conclusion that there actually was a sex act. The evidence on whether there was one or not was pretty complicated. It was very difficult to reach a conclusion, you know, beyond the shadow of a doubt that one occurred. So it's hard to tell whether they actually came to the point where they discussed whether Donna had a mental defect as defined by the law or not. But they sure were, you know, the jury members, you can watch them, obviously, in court, and they sure were riveted when the various experts talked about that issue in court.
I want to ask you before we start running out of time on this segment.
Sure.
You looked at this case. You reported on this case. You obviously, you know, got in, as you have explained, in depth on this. And I'm just wondering, as we're talking, as I'm listening to you, is this a case somewhat of a metaphor for this country's really inability historically to deal openly with issues of sex and sexuality, that it's still sort of like in many cases taboo or we don't talk about it?
Metaphor is a big word, but it's certainly that's a part of this case.
Yeah.
In fact, the juror who wrote her piece said that she had to talk to her other her fellow jurors, had to tell them about certain problems a female would have in her later years that would prevent her from having sex without certain aids. And she said she broke down in tears telling them about this because a lot of them were ignorant of it.
Wow.
And in fact, it bore on the case because it involved lubricants. And lubricants would have been necessary, and there were no lubricants in the room or nearby that night. So, you know, it was a piece of evidence, while at the same time, it was also an emotional statement on people just not wanting to, you know, face up to the realities of sexuality, particularly in this framework.
This is a maybe a little off the wall question, but do you think this case would have been brought to trial if it was in New Jersey or Massachusetts or New York as opposed to Iowa?
Well, first of all, I don't know the laws there.
Yeah.
So the laws could be different. But I see where you're getting at is, you know, are the people in Iowa more prudish? And I don't think that's necessarily the case. I don't know why this case was brought, and we'll probably never really know. But I suspect, based on the evidence, that it had a lot more to do with family dynamics than it did with prurient attitudes towards sex, although the latter obviously fit in. And when, if you were in the courtroom listening to the prosecutors, they were, it was obvious they were trying to prey on that, that sort of those attitudes.
So, you mentioned something. I remember from reading the initial article in the Times, as a clergyman who has worked with families and teaches some of this stuff, that seems to be one of the ongoing truths, that when you peel back that first or second layer, there's a lot of internal family dynamics operating here, and that family dynamic sometimes is the cause, or is the button that's pushed to create the scenario, or to create the case, or to create the craziness. And
right.
If I remember correctly, and I think you alluded to it, there were some issues with the adult children.
Yes.
And
this frequently, this is what happens.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dad is in the nursing home, and he's married to mom, who's still alive. And he ends up fooling around with another woman, and the family hears, and they go nuts, and, understandably so. He's still married, but he has dementia. And now you get into lots of complicated philosophical and legal issues. But in this case, at least you didn't have that complicating factor. I mean, these people were married, and they were very much in love.
Right.
And there's no evidence that there was anything untoward going on between them. But the two of the three daughters of Donna and Henry himself, and by extension his sons and daughters, they grew increasingly antagonistic leading up to the night of the alleged incident and then beyond. And, it didn't work out well for anybody. I mean, that's the sad part about this, is
right.
that, Henry was acquitted, and yes, he was relieved and happy that he was exonerated, but the guy's life was ruined.
We have about a minute left. Have you spoken to him since the trial?
I haven't spoken to Henry, but I've spoken to his son Dale, and we've spoken and texted, and so I check in to see how his dad's doing, and, some days are better than others.
We've been speaking with Brian Grulli, a reporter at large from Bloomberg News, really talking about this very, very fascinating Henry Rahan's case in Iowa last year and this year, and the possible implications of this case for a lot of our own families, because a lot of us will be dealing with issues of sexuality and sexual practice in facilities and nursing homes. Allied with issues of dementia and Alzheimer's. So, Mr. Grulli, thank you very, very much for being a guest here on Boomer Generation Radio. I wish you continued success, and take care of yourself. Enjoy the summer. Hopefully it goes
well.
Thank
you, too. Thanks for the excellent question.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Good luck.
You're welcome. To all of you, thank you for joining us here on this edition of Boomer Generation Radio. We have scheduled next week a very, very important and timely program with an author, A. Jen Poo, a book called The Age of Dignity. Hopefully she'll be with us on the whole issue of home health care workers and the need to, in essence, to organize them and raise a standard of living, professionalize them, something that many of us, including myself, have had to deal with. So hopefully we'll see you next week on Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860, WWDBAM.com. Have a great week, everyone. Thank you for listening.